Good afternoon from Florida's Space Coast, home of the most skilled aerospace workforce in America. I'm Jim Banky, and this is a special Labor Day weekend Best of Space Talk brought to you by United Space Alliance. Innovation you can trust, performance you can count on. Well, thanks for tuning in today on this long holiday weekend, in which we are just days away from the opening of the NFL season and the Vikings playing the Saints on Thursday night. It's certainly one of my favorite times of year. You know, growing up in Minnesota as I did, it was this weekend that, well, for kids anyway, began the parade of those special dates that led to Christmas and New Year's at the end of the year. You had Christmas in December, and before then, Thanksgiving in November, and then Halloween in October, and backing up into September, it was time to go back to school, but only after you had spent at least one day at the great Minnesota State Fair. And so that's what Mrs. Banky and I are doing on this September Labor Day weekend. So today I offer you this pre-recorded Best of Space Talk show to listen to. During the next hour, you'll hear clips from recent shows featuring Brian Mosdell from SpaceX, Patrick McCarthy from Space Florida, Wes Olszewski from Dr. Zuch Model Rockets. You'll hear from former NASA Flight Director and Shuttle Program Manager Wayne Hale, and you'll also hear from Apollo 11 Moonwalker Buzz Aldrin. And the man you're about to hear from to kick off our first segment, a veteran of four space shuttle missions, including one flight to the Russian space station Mir, former astronaut Jay Abt. In this clip, Jay talks about his time aboard the Russian outpost and answers a question from a young listener in North Carolina. And Jay, we do have a phone call for you today. Matthew, calling actually from Raleigh, North Carolina, has a question for you. Matthew, welcome to Space Talk.
Hi.
Hi, Matthew. Go ahead with your question. Mr. Abt is waiting.
While you're in space, what do you do in your free time?
Ah, Matthew, that's a great question. The best thing that we like to do was look out the window and take pictures of the Earth so we could share the experience with folks when we come back. We did that when we were supposed to be sleeping. We did that while we were eating. We did that while we were listening to the ground. Looking at the Earth is endlessly fascinating. This is a fantastic planet.
Matthew, you're interested in the space program, is my understanding. Isn't that right?
Yeah.
Yeah? Do you want to be an astronaut when you grow up?
Yes.
Really?
Terrific.
Good. Well, work hard, study hard, and be really good at something, okay?
Okay.
Call back again. Okay, there goes Matthew. I heard Matthew might be calling. It's great that he did.
That's terrific.
Jay, let's talk about the quick experience at the Mir space station. Not bad for Russians and for all that effort they put up there. That was a pretty handy little outpost, wasn't it?
Oh, it was great. It was huge. Looking at it while you were docked from the orbiter was wonderful, because looking out the overhead windows, you felt like you were in a sunny day because you had all this white reflective stuff overhead. And then scooting over there and seeing the folks that you trained with on that side of the Arctic Ocean, just right close to you. And they had some really nice gear there. It was no fancier than it needed to be, but it all worked. And it was a great station operated by good people.
Now, when you were involved in that and doing your training, and I'm sure you went to Star City and did the whole nine yards.
Sure.
Where were you at that point in the whole cultural thing? I'm one of the great lessons of Mir for NASA, of course, was this idea of sprint versus marathon. You know, every moment plan versus, you know, a list of things to do, and a whole different approach to the operations. Were you getting a sense of that yet? Had you had that sense already by the time you were up there? What was that like?
Sure. Well, you know, the Russians called the shuttle the Orgon, the hurricane, or the blizzard, when it came through, because, you know, we were all just geared up. We were following a flight plan that was programmed down to every 5 minutes and so forth, whereas they were more task-oriented. And just get this done today, and you know, we're not going to tell you exactly where the tools are and so forth. And, of course, for long-duration, long-distance flights, even if we go to Mars with a ion propulsion drive that only takes 3 weeks and so forth, and then get on Mars. That's the way it's going to have to be. We're going to have to do it with much less ground thinking about things and much more the folks in space thinking about things along with expert systems. One of the requirements for long-duration space flight is going to have to be more crew autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
You just can't afford to have this huge, very competent, but very expensive standing army of folks in mission control thinking for you. You're going to have expert systems with you and just think through yourself.
Make the decisions in real time on your own without having to keep calling back all the time.
You bet.
Yeah, absolutely.
With 45-minute one-way light time, that's just not practical, and we ought to be using the International Space Station to learn how to do that.
That's an interesting idea, almost like thinking of turning off TDRS two-thirds of the time and see what they do up there.
You bet.
Yeah, interesting. So now you came back from the fourth flight. You brought Shannon Lucid back. By the way, when Atlantis rolled over, Jay, you don't know this, when Atlantis rolled over for that mission from the hangar to the vehicle assembly building, I and my mother and a little group of tourists that we had, we were right practically under the wing, got to watch that. And forever, STS-79 has been like their flight. They've got patches, they've got pictures, and everything. So I know you didn't know that, but
oh, that's great.
But again, it made that personalization. And of course, that's something I've said a long time. When you personalize the shuttle program, when you personalize space flight program, you put someone up next to the rocket, they watch a launch, you almost have to convince them one person at a time. Suddenly they get it, you know, and the support is there for the rest of their life. And it's an amazing, amazing thing. And I know that, and so you left, you did your four flights, it was time to move on. And talk about just kind of big picture where you're at today, and talk about your orbitexperience.com, your website.
Well, when I came back from the first mission, I realized that we really needed to share the experience of looking at the Earth from space. And so we put together a team to put out a book that came out in 1996 called Orbit, NASA Astronauts Photograph the Earth.
Right.
National Geographic ended up publishing it. And it sold quite well, about 600,000 copies. Of course, I didn't get any royalties being a government employee.
Sure.
And so when I left NASA, I grabbed the Orbit Experience domain name and have a bunch of the pictures up there. And I do occasionally give lectures and so forth, and companies will ask me to come and talk. But my day job is as a professor at Carnegie Mellon University. I have an appointment in the Tepper School of Business and the Department of Engineering and Public Policy. My research is in the electric power industry. Of course, I tell people that I'm generally the only one in the room who owes their life to fuel cells and solar panels. but it's a wonderful field, and I'm just delighted to be in a fantastic university. I've got great PhD students, 9 of them at the moment. And you work your tail off. You know, nobody in the space program is any stranger to that.
Mm-hmm.
But gee whiz, just being at a university is fantastic.
That's great.
Our special Labor Day edition of the Best of Space Talk will continue with three of my good friends from college discussing the first Falcon 9 launch from the Cape and what it might mean to the future of our nation's space program. So please stick around. This is Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. I'm Jim Banky, and you're listening to WMMB. Welcome back to this special Labor Day edition of the Best of Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. Well, on the one-year anniversary of Space Talk, I invited three of my college buddies from Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University to come on the show and talk shop. And we spent much of our time discussing the first Falcon 9 launch, mostly because one of my guests that day was Brian Mosdell, who is in charge of SpaceX operations here in Florida. Also with me was Pat McCarthy from Space Florida, and Wes Olszewski, a well-known editorial cartoonist and creator of the Dr. Zuch line of model rockets.
So, Brian, let's start with you, because you have been... Boy, what has your life been like for the last few weeks, in months, in fact, or maybe even a couple of years? You have been in the eye of a hurricane that is no less the heart of the matter of our entire future of our U.S. space program.
And you must have been feeling it. You got the Falcon 9 off the ground. What's life been like for you?
Well, it's been very exciting, Jim. And I was fortunate enough to come join SpaceX about 2 years ago when we took over a launch pad that was just level to the ground. And I was fortunate enough to work with the team and lead the team to build up that site, get the launch pad ready for launch, and then successfully put the first Falcon 9 into orbit on June 4th. Along the way, we had visits from President Obama, so I was fortunate enough to meet him personally.
and of course, what's that like? I mean, whatever you feel about the guy, or the politics, or the story, or whatever, you had the President of the United States show up at the office one day.
It was pretty awesome, and the detail, the security detail that came with him was quite impressive.
Yeah. I mean, you couldn't get anywhere near him, I suppose, unless you could get near him.
Right. Yeah, and I was fortunate enough, he came in and met a group of us, and we walked out to the center of the launch pad. So I found myself walking literally right next to him, side by side.
Did he have any interesting things? I mean, did smart questions, did he show his support? Any interesting conversation?
Oh, yeah. He was very supportive of the program, asked lots of questions about the Falcon 9 and our launch operations. At one point, I'd offered to let him come down and press the button. And, unfortunately, he didn't take us up on that.
No. And probably smartly, perhaps, as you want your best guys pushing the buttons out there, I would imagine. And so Falcon 9 launches, and by all accounts, it hit the target, hit the bullseye. I know your boss, Elon, was very pleased and had a lot of good things to say. You know, is the pressure off now, or...?
Well, yeah, the pressure came off for about 36 hours.
Okay.
We've kind of gone from the fire into the frying pan. We have a very aggressive launch manifest, and you need to move out to get the COTS missions successfully executed and then move into our CRS role and start providing cargo up to the station.
And with about 30 seconds, Brian, I mean, did you ever think graduating from Embry-Riddle that, you know, these many years later you'd find yourself in the middle of something so spectacular?
I never thought I'd be at the heart of it. I assumed I'd be off designing wing lugs or something of that nature in Long Beach.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's great. And instead, you're building launch pads. You had a great experience with the Delta program and doing some other things, and now SpaceX coming by, and literally the future of the space program. Pat, you have your fingers on the pulse of what's going on in the space community. Certainly locally, you're involved with a lot of folks through your work at Space Florida. What's been the reaction about this launch, do you think, as you see it, from sort of the outside perspective looking in?
Well, I'd say we're sort of in the middle of it, because obviously it's a politically charged kind of occurrence, because we've got the folks that believe that NASA should be the one and only way of taking people to space. And then we've got the commercial folks that are saying they're the better answer because they can do things less expensive and more efficiently.
Yeah.
But what we're trying to do is match up the people and the workers that we have here. I mean, like you say in your introduction, you know, it's home to the best trained workforce, space workforce in the world. So that's the kind of thing we're trying to apply. Make sure that whichever way the Congress and the people of America decide to go, that we'll be able to apply the right folks from the jobs that they have here to the companies that are come in, whether they're providing government contracts or whether they're doing it for commercial operators.
Well, but the thing that bothers me about this debate, because you alluded to it just now, is that it doesn't have to be. Why does it have to be commercial or NASA? I mean, certainly starting with delivery of cargo to the International Space Station, or the delivery of any cargo to low Earth orbit or geosynchronous orbit or anywhere in space, there's certainly a role for commercial to do it. Commercial's been doing it for years, launching commercial satellites on commercial rockets. And so to have a group like SpaceX come along and find a new way to do it that's less expensive, more streamlined, with reliable hardware, seems to make a lot of sense. But why not put humans on top of this thing and let a commercial entity fly them if it's safe to do? I mean, is it a technical issue or is it an economic issue? Wes, what do you think?
Well,
or is it a political issue?
Yeah. Well, coming from the standpoint of a editorial cartoonist that centers on primarily aviation aerospace subjects, I can say that I look at the entire situation and I say, wow, what a great amount of stuff to cartoon on.
Yeah, really. Because lots of good material.
It's like you said, you have the two sides. But the reason why we have the two sides is because of the Obama budget proposal. It has proposed that we eliminate NASA's ability to launch astronauts and give it all to the commercial sector. But if you watch the hearings in the Congress, which I've been watching since August, and I was just saying here recently that I study those hearings like the Zapruder films. You
right,
know, frame by frame. And what I've seen is that the Congress keeps saying what we need is we need the two to develop in parallel. We need to have a NASA capability for launching astronauts, and we also need to have a commercial capability for launching humans into spaceflight. And I don't see any reason why we can't do that. It's chump change compared to what this country is spending on other things right now. Mm-hmm. It's absolute chump change. There's no reason why we can't give the money that is proposed to the commercial side and have them develop. As a matter of fact, I think we should give them more money to develop.
Right.
And then also have a NASA capability. But that doesn't necessarily mean we have to go with Ares 1 and Constellation exactly as it has been. We can modify it other than destroy it. You don't just take all of this and throw it out in one shot. So I think that whole proposal, that portion of the proposal, is very ill-conceived. And the metaphor I like to use is, well, you had Miles O'Brien on a few weeks ago, and he made this metaphor about the interstate highway system and so on. The metaphor I like to use is, let's say there was a new burger joint in town, and it was the best. They advertised, we're the best burger. You went there, and they gave you this big burger, and you looked at that bun, and man, it was just bakery quality, wonderful, huge burger. And it's just, this is it. And fresh tomatoes, a fresh lettuce, and you open it up, and right there is a giant cow pie.
Yeah.
Now, would you eat the burger?
Would you?
Because it's 75% of it is really good.
But.
Okay. But there's a part of it, there's a core to it, there's an important part of it that is not. And that's the way I see, that's my metaphor for the Obama budget. I think what we have to do is we have to replace that part with something that works for Congress and works for the American people in the future of this country.
And is that replacement, is that part that's missing, is it hardware or is it vision stuff? You know, I mean,
it's both.
And it is both. You know, they said we're taking away Constellation, and immediately, you know, the reaction is, well, we're shutting down human spaceflight. Well, no, you're not shutting down human spaceflight. You're still doing trips to the space station. There's still opportunities to do other things. But it's the hardware that you're getting.
You're
rid
shutting
of.
Down NASA's capability to do human spaceflight. So you're shutting down the United States government's capability, the United States capability to do its own human spaceflight, other than in the commercial area. The commercial will develop fine if we give it the space and give it the time. But right now we don't have the time.
Well, but Brian, you're looking at the other side of this, and of course, you're an engineer by training. You had no social life when we were in college. And okay, it's true, right? but in terms of the money, is it a matter of throwing money at you? I guess what I'm trying to ask is that, you know, the problem that comes, the critics. I'm in radio, by the way.
The critics
say, well, there's no market for commercial for manned spaceflight. So how is commercial going to survive if there's no market? But is it a market issue? Is the technical part, quote unquote, easy? And it is the market problem? I mean, how do you guys look at that?
Well, you know, the technical part is definitely achievable. I would never, you know, characterize it as easy.
No, right.
You know,
Or routine.
I mean, the program is committed to safety, and that in itself drives complexity into the hardware, into the processing. So, but just some of the other comments, you know, backing up what Wes was saying, I don't see the two sides as mutually exclusive.
Right.
You know, I see NASA's role in developing, you know, manned space flight to achieve maybe some other goals, as opposed to routine transport of, you know, cargo and crew to station, and just turning over that piece, you know, to a commercial company like SpaceX, you know, through the CRS program and then hopefully COTS-D, you know, will serve the country well. And I think it's a shame that some of the folks who are on the anti-SpaceXers see SpaceX as the reason that Constellation, you know, is being shut down,
right,
as opposed to just the economy.
Stick around for more of this Best of Space Talk show, as we'll hear next from none other than Buzz Aldrin, right after we get caught up on the latest news, weather, and sports. Space Talk is brought to you by United Space Alliance. I'm Jim Bankey, and you're listening to WMMB.
Be here for the heroes in orange jumpsuits.
Be here to feed your curiosity.
Be here for the goosebumps.
Major goosebumps.
Be here for the eye-opening.
Jaw-dropping.
Excitement.
Of exploring space.
Be here for a day of fun.
And a lifetime of inspiration.
Be here at Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex. Now through September 6th, Florida residents receive a free child admission with each paid adult. Restrictions apply. Download your coupon at kennedyspacecenter.com/Florida.
Well, and welcome back to our second half of Space Talk on WMMB, brought to you by United Space Alliance. Innovation you can trust, performance you can count on. Well, on this pre-recorded edition of the show, we're playing back some of our favorite moments during the past few months on the show so that I can be in Minnesota this weekend enjoying some cooler weather and a trip to the Minnesota State Fair. Well, this past summer, we celebrated the 41st anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing, and we were honored to have Buzz Aldrin join us to talk about the flight and his vision for the future of our space program.
First lunar landing mission. Neil Armstrong, of course, was the commander. Mike Collins was the command module pilot. And Buzz Aldrin was the lunar module pilot. And as you all well know, on July 20th, 1969, Neil and Buzz became the first men to land and walk on the moon. And because of that feat four decades ago, I really don't need to say anything else, I don't think, by way of introduction, except to say, of course, I'm honored to welcome to the program today none other than the legendary Buzz Aldrin. Buzz, welcome to Space Talk.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Jim. I'm very happy to be talking to you from the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, very cool. Now, you spent the last couple hours doing a book signing, and you had a lot of interest there. You see that interest, don't you? The general public still cares about this program.
Well, I sure do. There were just all sorts of different people from different nations, young people that just were wide-eyed as could be, and very happy tourists coming by, and I just was really thrilled to see their appreciation and memory of the things that this country did 40 years ago.
Well, let's ask you a couple of the obligatory anniversary type questions. I know that the 41st anniversary is not exactly a big celebrated milestone like the fives are and all that. But in any case, after all this time, Buzz, you know, when you think back to those times, really even starting when you were selected and all through Gemini and Apollo, you know, what's the most vivid memory for you? I would assume those memories are still vivid. You know, what do you think about as a highlight? What really resonates with you after all these years?
Well, there were so many events during that mission itself, and it took 8 days total, 3.5 days to get to the moon, about 1 day there, actually 20 hours plus a little bit on the surface of the moon, and about 2.5 hours for Neil outside, about a little over 2 hours for me to be outside on the lunar surface. But I think the most significant recollection and event really consisted of the first landing on another object by a machine created by human beings and operated and landed by human beings so that then they could explore the landing itself. And, of course, the 11 minutes or so of power descent where we slowed down from orbital speed. And at that time, if the engine quit, we were going to crash. And at any time during that 11 minutes, if something happened, we were not on a survivable trajectory unless we did very critical things like jettisoning the descent stage, lighting up the ascent stage, and then getting back into a proper orbit. So really, landing on another object was the culmination of the commitment to go to the moon. Once you land, you can land a second time, a third time, a sixth, seventh, and eighth, and then you can land on another object like an asteroid, or you can land on Mars. And once you know how to land, then you can
send people outside, and they can do whatever you want to do as many days as you are able to do it.
Right.
So the actual touchdown instant that was successful, I think, is the most significant in my mind. And it was preceded, of course, by a light coming on in the cockpit that indicated that a probe from the landing gear had just touched the lunar surface, and it caused that light to be turned on. And as I saw that, I told Neil, engine stop, and a few other things. And that's what happened in those fractions of a second as we touched down on the lunar surface. When it became okay to say a few words back to Earth, back to Houston, instead of talking to each other, why, Neil Armstrong gave those prophetic words, Houston, Tranquility Base, the Eagle has landed.
Yeah, isn't that great? And when you know, there was definitely emotion in Mission Control as they all let out their whoops and stuff. Of course, you guys being the professional engineers, astronauts, pilots, with all those switches to throw and checklists to go through, I imagine there wasn't a single emotion in your body when you finally realized you landed, right?
Well, of course, being the rendezvous expert where I had studied rendezvous while at MIT, and of course that was my entree ticket into the astronaut business,
right?
Because I hadn't been I hadn't personally selected the option of becoming trained as a test pilot in my Air Force career. So really, it was my work at MIT on rendezvous that made the big difference. After touchdown, I was quite aware that we had several opportunities, T1, T2, T3, mm-hmm. that it would be appropriate to lift off at that time if anything was leaking, if anything was wrong with the spacecraft after we touched down. So I was quite conscious of the countdown to those times. And the reason that those times occur a minute and something after touchdown is so that if we lifted off, Mike Collins and Columbia would be in a favorable position to catch up with him and to complete the rendezvous. But once T3 had passed, then we were stuck on the surface for 2 hours until he came over again.
Wow! Wow! And that, and of course, Mike was very anxious to stay on top of that and worried a lot about that. Very well articulated in his book, Carrying the Fire. Buzz, the questions are lining up here, and we're gonna take a few as best we can and stick to the topic. Jim,
sure.
Jim from West Melbourne, he says he was 13 in 1969. I think he has a question that's going to allow you to say something nice about the local folks. Jim, what's your question?
Yes, thank you so much. Thank you, Mr. Aldrin, and congratulations 40 years later. I was 13. My father was one of the support people out there. So many of them, there's no way for you to know, but if I could just tell you very quickly, he was a guy who had to quit school in the eighth grade because his father was so ill, working a farm up in North Dakota, and he ended up down here in the 50s and working at the Space Center, and he handled the liquid oxygen and liquid nitrogen, high-pressure gas, and actually got awards from NASA for his procedures that he wrote. And I thought maybe you'd like to comment on some of those thousands of support people who helped you to get to the moon.
Jim, that's a great comment and great question. Thanks for calling. And yeah, Buzz, you guys were the top of the pyramid on top of that Saturn V, but you know who supported you.
Well, there's no doubt that we became aware of that from the moment that we were selected as astronauts. In my case, back in October of 1963, I had applied for the astronaut program in 1962, along with my good friend from West Point, Ed White,
right,
who was later killed in the Apollo fire. But he was qualified, and I wasn't because I didn't have the test pilot qualifications. But the next year, they modified those so that that was not a requirement, put more emphasis on education, so I was selected. So from that point on, we had a a suspicion that we just might be a part of a great national commitment and effort to land some of us on the moon before the end of the 1960s, before January 1st, 1970. And as the team began to form around this epic mission and define exactly how we were going to carry this out, more and more people from industry, different companies, different agencies of the U.S. government, the State Department, the Commerce Department, of course, NASA, and many other agencies began to really concentrate and assemble the people, call on the universities, and, of course, the political people in Congress. And the White House, of course, had to continue their support. So there was upwards of 400,000 people, but a whole nation really began to solidify behind this effort as the time became closer and closer.
We'll take our final break, and when we return, we'll hear from former flight director and shuttle program manager Wayne Hale as he talks about NASA and commercial spaceflight. And if you didn't hear it the first time, I guarantee you won't want to miss what he had to say. This is Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. I'm Jim Banky, and again, you're listening to WMMB. Well, welcome back as we begin our final segment of today's special Labor Day weekend edition of the Best of Space Talk, sponsored by United Space Alliance. Well, 2 weeks after he retired from NASA on July 31st, Wayne Hale came on the program to talk about his departure and share his thoughts for the future. Here he is from a show just a couple of weeks ago.
Not sure there's a business case for it, but do you think that NASA might, or might, whether on purpose or not, levy so much insider oversight into what the commercial space folks want to do that it would make them difficult for them to do it in an economical way that they want to do it?
Well, you know, as I spent my last several months in the agency working on exactly that problem, I am very afraid that the agency will put too much bureaucracy and turn the SpaceX's and the Orbitals and the other folks, these new entrepreneurial, flexible, you know, businesses, into aerospace contractors much like Boeing or Lockheed, because the first drafts, at least, of the requirements that have come out of the mill there are very much business as usual. Lots of oversight, lots of heavy government requirements. And I'll be real frank with you, Jim. One of the reasons that impelled me to leave was I was lobbying very hard to try to change some of that and was not making a lot of headway.
Yeah, and how much of all that oversight is cultural bureaucracy versus or also risk-averse?
Well, you know, the system is built up over many years, and it all started with good intentions, trying to make sure that the work is done to the highest standards and ensuring safety. And some of that is definitely required to provide a reliable, safe launch vehicle or spacecraft. But the fact of the matter is, and I can speak to this from the in-house, we've gone overboard. The agency has become bureaucratic, and it becomes very difficult to do what you need to do and not trip over some of these regulations and requirements. And you certainly spend a lot of time trying to work your way out of some of these things. And at the end of the discussion, you find out that probably it's just been an exercise and a gab fest. It's really sad. Now, some of it's good, but some of it is really burdensome.
Well, and while you're saying that, the return to flight after Columbia. And we had that little, the little shim piece in the tiles.
Yes.
And all that work and effort to go pull that thing out because there was a concern about heating. And I understand it was the first flight after Columbia, and I understand tiles were sensitive then. But, you know, after all these years and all the things that vehicle's been through, you know, I always thought that this was the beginning of, not the end, but the beginning of this, we've gone overboard.
Well, I you know, from folks, maybe from your standpoint on the outside of the agency, that became apparent to you at that point. I'll tell you, from inside, it was apparent to me long before that we had gone overboard in many areas and made it more costly and more difficult. Now, I'm not sure what the factor is, whether cutting back on that bureaucratic overhead would save you 10% or 25%. I don't think it'll save you 90% of the cost of a launch vehicle, which is what some of the really commercial ideologue people believe will happen. Prices will come down as we find an appropriate way to pursue things in the future. Really, the cost of getting into low Earth orbit is the biggest hurdle to the exploration of space right now.
Oh,
so I welcome some fresh and innovative ideas and the pressures of the marketplace that may help us make better decisions on some of these areas.
Well, and now, Dwayne, with a couple of minutes left, let's lighten up a little bit here. And you've also just mentioned in one of your last blogs about this book.
Right.
That you're working on, and I'm very excited about this. I'm very much looking forward to it. Talk about this little writing project that you and your shuttle team members have been working on.
Well, you know, after the president announced that we're going to retire the shuttle about 5 years ago, we decided that it would be good. There are going to be a lot of books. There have been a lot of books. Will be in the future a lot of books written about the space shuttle, what it did, what it accomplished, what it meant. We thought it would be good to capture a book from those of us who really worked inside the program, our perspective, so that our story would be told. And so we have several hundred contributors, and it's been very hard to get a shuttle book in one volume. We probably could have written an encyclopedia set.
Wow.
But our book, Wings in Orbit, is going to the publisher very shortly. We have all the content in, and the final proofing and editing is being completed, and we'll be going to the publisher very shortly. Of course, we thought the shuttle program was going to end this September. It won't contain the last couple of flights, but the book should be available at your bookstore in late January, early February, and you can order advanced copies online. I don't have the link right in front of me, but if you search on it, I think on the web you can find a link, and it's certainly on the NASA webpage. Get an advanced order in for the book. And I think you'll find out many things that you did not know about the space shuttle.
Give me, in 20 seconds, Wayne, give me one good example.
Oh, gosh. We talk about the scientific accomplishments, and I was astounded, even having worked in the program, at some of the scientific accomplishments that were done in the observatories and human experimentation. And I really can't talk a whole lot about it because we don't have time, but, you know, we have a new vaccine that's coming out for Salmonella, the food poisoning,
mm-hmm.
which was discovered in space through some of the work that happened in cooperation between the space shuttle and space station researchers.
Absolutely neat. And in fact, there's a local angle to that story, and that's a great topic for another issue of Space Talk. Wayne, we got to wrap it up with you, sir. Thank you so much for being on and being on this show for only 2 weeks after your retirement. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you, and best wishes, and we will definitely stay in touch with you.
Thank you very much. My pleasure to talk with you anytime, Jim.
Great. Thanks, Wayne. We'll take care and give your grandkids a hug.
Well, that's all we have for you this week. I hope you enjoyed hearing some of our favorite guests again. Next week, September 11th, we will be back with a live show, and our guest will be the commander of the 45th Space Wing, at Patrick Air Force Base, the Commander Brigadier General Ed Wilson. We'll talk about military space operations, what's going on now and in the future at Cape Canaveral Air Force Station, and we'll honor our friends and neighbors who are serving overseas on the 9th anniversary of the terrorist attacks on America. And I'm sure we'll also talk about the launch calendar for the rest of the year, which, by the way, right now has a Delta IV Heavy targeted for launch on October 19th, and then SpaceX's Falcon 9 is looking to fly at the end of October, their second mission from here, and after that, Shuttle Discovery is set to go up to the International Space Station on November 1st,
and then that should be it for 2010. And that's it for today for our program. Thanks for listening. Space Talk is sponsored by United Space Alliance and is a production of Mylas Solutions. Aaron Michaels is my personal chief engineer for the show. And the Home Mortgage Law Show is next here on WMMB. I'm Jim Bankey. Go Vikings! And we'll talk to you again real soon.